is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. What do we need to know to really understand how we Americans are seen in the world? I mean, what if we could find some ultimate historical master webcam where we could clearly see how we are viewed, that's actually been watching us since 1776? What would we see? Would we like what we see? Well, it's certainly the case that the disconnect between who Americans think they are and how the world views this country is becoming one of the defining fault lines that shapes American foreign policy and the ways in which the people of the world confront American foreign policy. Case in point, today in the Japanese city of Hiroshima, Secretary of State John Kerry visited the memorial to the dead from the atomic bombing in August of 1945, in which 80,000 civilians were killed immediately and 60,000 others died later from the after effects.
It is a stunning display. It is a gut-wrenching display. It tugs at all of your sensibilities as a human being. It reminds everybody of the extraordinary complexity of choices in war and of what war does to people, to communities, countries, to the world.
Complexity. Does it remind everyone of complexity, or just someone like Secretary Kerry, now the highest-ranking official to go to Hiroshima? The consistent position of the United States is that the first use of a nuclear weapon developed to fight the Germans was needed to prevent an invasion of Japan. More than 70 years later, should there be a rethinking of that decision? Was it a consequence of war? Was it an act of terrorism that launched the Cold War? We'll talk about that a little later this hour. Thinking of terrorism, though, the key remaining suspect in November's Paris attacks was arrested late Friday. Mohamed Abrini was captured in Belgium, working for ISIS. Why? What can ISIS do to the United States from Belgium? How does ISIS see the United States? Is that something we can change? Is that something we should try and change? For more than a decade, CNN host and Washington Post columnist Fareed Zakaria has explored radicalization and violent jihad, the frame Why They Hate Us, the title of a new CNN documentary special, comes from a column he wrote years ago for Newsweek magazine. Fareed Zakaria, welcome.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You talk a lot about history, what's changed since you first posed the question, why do they hate us after 9/11? How has that question changed, do you think?
I think in two ways. The first is we now know something about the area where all this hatred is emanating out of, which is the Middle East and the Arab world in particular. And we realize these societies are even more broken than I thought. And once you start trying to reform them, what you discover is, think about Egypt, Libya, Iraq, Syria. Once you get rid of the guy at the top, it turns out there's no state underneath. There is no civil society underneath. In many cases, there's no country underneath. And so these societies very quickly devolve into a kind of political vacuum, a war of all against all, and people retreat to very old identities, not national identities, which are, you know, created in 1919, 1920, but to their identities as Shias, Sunnis, Kurds, Turkmens. These are thousand-year-old identities. And so the task has become much more complicated. And the second is that you have a new generation of jihadis, particularly in Europe, who are young, alienated, not particularly religious, who are drawn to this for the adventure, for the thrill, for the contrast between their miserable, alienated lives, often in which they have spent most of it in kind of petty crimes, often in jail. And those two features, it strikes me, as are the new reality we face: a broken Middle East and a very alienated group of non-religious jihadis.
Rashid Khalidi talks a little bit about what he thinks is motivating many of the contemporary jihadis. And listen to what he says here.
In many cases, they're petty criminals. In many cases, they're dropouts. In many cases, they're unemployed. In many cases, they're drug users who never had anything to do with religion, have no religious training whatsoever.
You probably know it's not better than me even. Maybe you have studied.
They're completely ignorant, in other words, of religion. And they latch onto radical Islam as a way to act out their alienation.
Do you buy that?
There's no question it's true for the vast majority of this new generation of European recruits. I think there are obviously some who are deeply religious. The old model, the Al-Qaeda model, was a different one. These people were in their 30s often. They were deeply religious, and they had gotten to their radicalism through religion. The European jihadis now that we see in Brussels and Paris, they tend to be 20 years old, 10 years younger. They are often petty criminals. They have no background in Islam. They were radicalized before they were Islamized. And so what you're dealing with is a different phenomenon. It's alienated young men, often in the prisons of France and Belgium. I came to this by trying to figure out a puzzle. Belgium had the largest number of jihadis that were being sent to Iraq and Syria. And I thought to myself, why is this? Why Belgium, of all places? Well, it turns out Belgium has the largest inequality in income, in opportunity, in education between their migrants, who are essentially Moroccans, and their native borns. It also has the worst track record by most measures of assimilation. And that's particularly a Belgian problem because Belgium has no real national identity itself, torn between its Flemish and Walloon identities. And so that began to explain why Belgium had ended up being this incredible feeding ground. And I do buy the idea that, you know, what you're dealing with here is people who are in some kind of revolt against their circumstances, their surroundings, the modern world, who are looking for an off-the-shelf ideology of protest. Now, it's fair to say Islam today has within it this cancer, this radical political Islam that is a very convenient off-the-shelf ideology of protest. And why does that exist? Because of decades of having been created, fostered, nurtured by countries like Saudi Arabia.
Like the United States.
Countries like the United States.
I mean, there are billionaires who are Muslims who were part of the Mujahideen movement in Afghanistan who to this day operate outside of Afghanistan and in Iran. Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, for instance, made millions upon millions of dollars from being a part of that movement. And, you know, if the U.S. gives them such a boost, why should we be so surprised that they wouldn't, you know, succeed?
In the 1980s, we believed that the enemy, you know, the enemy of our enemy is our friend. So anyone who was battling the Soviet Union was a good guy. And that's why we supported Osama bin Laden. That's why we supported people like Hekmatyar, one of the warlords in Afghanistan. And it turned out these people were not our friends. By the way, the Israelis did something very similar when Hamas...
Yeah, they created Hamas.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, Hamas is not a Muslim movement. It's a creation of the Israeli state.
In a sense, it's both. And the Israelis at the time, I remember talking to some of them, would say, no, you don't understand. Our real enemy is radical left-wing Soviet-backed groups like the PLO. This is a conservative religious group. I mean, they have a lot in common with the, you know, conservative Jewish groups that we know. And so, the world has changed a lot. But my point is that for whatever reason, that ideology now exists. And so when an alienated young European immigrant or a child of an immigrant, which is what it usually is looking around, there is this off-the-shelf ideology. It's on the internet. It's, you know, there are sermons, and that's what they reach for. It's not to deny the importance of religion, but it's to recognize that it's a more complicated story in which there is alienation first, radicalization, and then Islamization.
You speak with a fellow on trial in London, Anjem Chowdhury, who is very angry at the United States. He's also very articulate. And let's listen to an exchange between the two of you.
And then the floodgates open with the reasons why Anjem Chowdhury says he hates us.
Freedom of expression, freedom of religion. These things sound very nice, but where is the freedom of religion and expression for people in Guantanamo Bay? What about the people being tortured in Abu Ghraib and Bagram? Was that freedom in practice? I bet you loved that, didn't you, Fareed? Did you hold that up as an example of liberty and democracy, the American way, the American life?
Is he wrong to say that Guantanamo is a systematic denial of human rights on any level of prisoners?
No, but what I would point out is, you know, 9/11 was planned when there was no Guantanamo. The attack on the USS Cole was planned when there was no Guantanamo. The attacks on the embassies in Tanzania and Kenya were planned when there was no Guantanamo. You know, so what he is cherry picking a few terrible examples of American mistakes, even crimes, you could call them, And he is claiming that that was the reason for the jihad, but the jihad well preceded it.
Mr. Chaudhry, and this we'll conclude on this. Mr. Chaudhry seems to know your work very, very well, and I know that you know that he does. He follows it. A lot of people in the Muslim world follow your work. He seemed to kind of wink and nod that you're a mouthpiece for American mythology. Do you run the risk of becoming in the English-speaking world and the American world, for instance, which isn't terribly knowledgeable about Islam, being, you know, kind of Egyptian Muslim explainer dude, and that is a limitation ultimately on your ability to elucidate what's going on in the world?
I face many challenges in this regard. You know, I came to the world of international relations as a scholar. I got my PhD at Harvard. It had nothing to do with Islam.
Right.
I wrote about, you know, U.S. foreign policy between the Civil War and Theodore Roosevelt. And then 9/11 happens, and I just know a lot about this because I grew up in that world. My father was actually an Islamic scholar, and so I sort of ended up spending more time and more of my effort explaining it. I feel as though I have to be true to myself, and that person is a very passionate, patriotic American immigrant who also happens to know a lot about the world of Islam and understands how it is being unfairly vilified and demonized. And I try to represent those two positions. There are some people who think I'm an Uncle Tom. I've had a fatwa issued against me by a very serious radical imam. And I get, if you were to look at my Twitter feed, I get the most ugly kinds of bigoted, racist stuff on there. And maybe, you know, in the middle there somewhere, I feel as though I'm telling the truth.
Fareed Zakaria, thank you so much.
It's such a pleasure to be on.
Fareed Zakaria, host of CNN's Fareed Zakaria GPS program, and he's a columnist for The Washington Post.